Okay, thank you very, very much, Rob Andrew, and thank you all for coming. I was quite happy just to sit around the table with Eleanor and a few friends and discuss this topic, but I'm very happy to be here as well. I just want to, first of all, thank Mark and Eleanor, Mark in absentia, who's in Poland. That would have been nice to see him, but Eleanor especially. Shiki, are you here? Where's she going? She's in the kitchen. Fine. But not only hosting very graciously and you know enabling us all to be together with such you know lovely food and in a great environment, but also very valiantly printing off the sheets when there was a technical glitch. The sheets didn't arrive, and then within minutes she had them a team put together, and they were all put together here. So they are courtesy of her. And I actually think this is very important, because even though I won't be going through every single source on the sheet slavishly, this is a good sort of pack for you to take away and think about and study, etc. There's a lot here. There's a lot more I could have put on here, but don't think we're going to read every word of these 8 pages, otherwise we'd be here all night. What I wanted to talk about, and you know, there are different ways of looking at this issue. This is just my structure, my analysis, my suggestion as to how it could work. There are other people who say other things. I'm certainly not suggesting that this is the only way of looking at it, but I find this helpful, and other people have told me they found this helpful, which is to try and ask the question, what is authentic halakhic change, authentic, you know, maybe in brackets or in whatever quotes, as opposed to inauthentic halakhic change. And let's just frame this topic first. In the Orthodox world, from right to left, there is a common commitment to following halakha, Jewish law. Meaning if a person is part of the Reform community, then Jewish law is not relevant to the way that they live their Judaism, and they have another system, if you like, of connecting to what they feel is true and correct. Halakha is not part of that. And the conservative movement we'll talk a little bit about as to how what their relationship is. But in the Orthodox world, Jewish law is binding. However one interprets it and decides it, that's a common understanding. And there are, if you like, two extremes on this topic, which I think we need to move away from. One on the right and one on the left. The extreme framing on the right, if you like, is Jewish law does not change. It doesn't change. Jewish law was given to Moses on Mount Sinai and passed down faithfully since, and what we do now is what we do then, and any suggestion that there's any kind of evolution or development is just wrong, or maybe even heretically wrong. Okay? And you can find supports apparently for that. You know, if you open Maimonides' 13 Principles of Faith and look at number 8, he'll say the Torah we have now is the Torah that was given to Moshe Rabbeinu and that was passed down, etc. Now actually when you get into that, he's not talking about the halakha. He's talking about the written Sefer Torah, which is not really what we're talking about tonight. But there is a viewpoint, if you like, that nothing ever changed and nothing ever will change. That is clearly not true. Any scratching, even slightly below the surface, will show that Jewish law has been in development for thousands of years. And you can just see that. You only have to learn it a little bit to realize that there has been a development. The Talmud didn't always exist. It was written at a certain point of time. They didn't have one before. They didn't make another one afterwards. So that's something massive that changed. And there are other things as well that we'll talk about. You know, when you see these kids' book and kids' Bible books or whatever, from pictures of Moshe and Aaron, they're all wearing strimals, you know, and they're wandering around. This is really reinforcing this narrative that, like, the way we look now, who we are, is the way they look then, and what we do is what they did, etc. So that's a narrative which is just wrong, and there's no point going down that road, an easily provable one. On the other side, if you like, of the Orthodox world is, let's say, the very left-wing narrative. This is best expressed, perhaps, by Blue Greenberg. Blue Greenberg, who did some very, very important work in, you know, working with the Feminist Alliance and the Jofa, etc., and who coined a certain phrase, which she later denied that she meant it in this way or whatever, but it's a very helpful phrase I'm trying to kind of move away from, but it goes like this. She said, where there's a rabbinic will, there's a halakhic way. And that narrative basically is, you know something, anything can change. The rabbis can do it. Why are they not doing it? Because they don't want to do it. They've got this big jar of, you know, sweets, and they keep the lid screwed on very, very tight, and they don't give anybody, let anyone into it. And if you nudge them just enough, and you make enough, they'll open it and throw you one and say, okay, that's it. That's all you get. But if you just lobby and lobby and lobby and lobby, if they want to change it, they can change it. Now again, she also knows that that is just not the way halacha works. And if a person thinks that is how halacha works, that's also an ignorant approach to what halacha is. You can't change everything. There are some things you can, there are some things you can't. So those two extreme narratives, nothing ever changes, and everything can change, you just have to get rabbis who want to change it, are both wrong. And they're demonstrably wrong. The truth, of course, is somewhere in the middle. And again, like I said, I might not be the only way of looking at it this way, what I'm going to describe to you, but I want to give you a structure which has four boxes, okay? There are four types of halachic change that you might think about, and I think rather than just have everything in a big chulance, I find a lot of people ask questions and it's all one big sort of mush in their head. And they have all sorts of questions and they say things like, you know, why don't women dance with a Sefer Torah? And why can't, you know, this? And why can't a woman give a get to a man? And why do we still do this? And why do we still do this? And why do that? And these are all good questions. But I think when people often have these questions, you have to list them down and go, well, actually they go in different boxes. There are different kinds of change that people are suggesting, and if you can get them in the right box, at least in our minds, then we can work out, well, that can't ever change. That might change at some point. This could change today, and this should change right now. Okay? And we'll see how that works as a suggestion structure. Okay? So that's what I'd like to do with you. I have 40 minutes or so. I'd love to have time for questions. And you can talk about this for months and months and months and months. On my website, let me make a plug, I don't get any money for you going on my website. I just get nachas that someone goes on my website. I think it's usually just my mother clicking on my website. But that's okay. I have a website. You can get access to it. It's there, rabbimanning.com at the bottom. I have about 70 or 80 shiurim, probably more, maybe 100, on this topic. Different developments and different ideas, and you can go on there and see, you know, some of these things in more depth. So let's just start with a quote from Rabbi Eliezer Berkowitz. Rabbi Eliezer Berkowitz from Chicago, passed away many, many decades ago, wrote a very interesting book called Not in Heaven, which I recommend, and he describes the halachic system. And I'm not going to read number two, you can read that in your own time, but in number one, he sets the frame which I'd like to look at with you. How to face the confrontation between the text and the actual life situation. How to resolve the problems arising out of the confrontation is the task of the Torah Sheba'al Peh, the oral law. This second Torah, ever since the days of Moses, handed down from generation to generation, accompanies the Torah Shebichtav, the written law, the written word, along its journey of realization in the innumerable concrete situations through which the Jewish people passes in the course of its history. It is the wisdom of Torah implementation in the daily life of the Jewish people. It makes the Torah, Torat Chaim, living, teaching, and relevant law. Meaning, Rav Berkowitz's approach here, his structure, which in number two you'll see when you read it later, is that we have a dream team. We have a written Torah, which sets the red lines. It can never change. It was given to us at a certain point in history. It's set down. It's set in stone. There's a reason that it's set in stone. You can't change it even if you want to. You can't rub it out. And therefore, that's something that is not negotiable. It's not justiciable. It is what it is. And then you have an oral law, which is potentially changing and developing and evolving. And the written law is given by God, but the oral law is developed by people. Well, which people we'll see? We'll see that soon. You know, rabbis, men, women, we'll see. But the oral law is constantly developing and accompanying the written law. And that allows you to avoid two problems, he says. If you only had the written law but no oral law, then it would become fossilized and frozen, and it would cease to be relevant very quickly to have a 3,400-year-old oral law, and written law rather, applicable today. But if you only had the oral law, only had autonomy, the problem with autonomy, he says, and that's how we run our secular, you know, countries today, America, England, whatever, meaning is the law is whatever we want it to be. And even if you have a constitution, you can change the constitution, we could do the most outrageously horrible things if the people just agreed. Because there's no red lines. There are no red lines. They could make a rule in England or America or whatever that only people over 30 will be allowed to live. Okay, what a ridiculous thing to do. Yeah, okay, is there anything that stops them? No. If the people of that country say, we're going to change our constitution, there are no red lines. And that's one of the issues that we face today in English law and American law. Even if you have a constitution, there are no ultimate red lines. So in halacha, there are red lines in the written law, but there's a very vibrant interpretive process which is autonomous within that, in order to develop it as well. So you manage to avoid the two problems of complete fossilization, but then no red lines and complete autonomy. So there's a that's just as a starting point what's going on. So my suggestion to you is that these four boxes are as follows. Box one is someone comes along and says, I want to change the Torah law itself, the written law, the law that's in the Chumash. I want to change that. I don't like that mitzvah. I want Shabbos to be on a Thursday. I want, pigs to be kosher. I want marriage between Jews and non-Jews, or between men, or between women. You want to change whatever you want to change, but it's in the Torah itself. That's box number one. Okay, we're going to see that's not something that we can change, and whether we will ever change that, we'll talk about that in a second. Box number two is someone comes along and says, I don't want to change the Torah law. No, I'm not messing around with that. I respect that. It's in stone. But I don't like the interpretation of the rabbis. The rabbis lived a long time ago. We have a different take on things now. Why can't we just change the rabbinic interpretation of the law? Change rabbinic laws. You know, a minyan is 10 men over the age of 13. Let's make it 5 men and 5 women. Why not? That's not in the Torah. It doesn't say anywhere in the Torah you have to have 10 men for a minyan. That's a rabbinic law. So, okay, so we have rabbis today. Let's change the rabbinic law to a new law. That's box two. Okay, we'll see. That is possible, but not right now. We'll see how that works. Box three is someone comes along and says, I don't want to change the Torah law. I don't even want to change the rabbinic law. Where the rabbinic law is clear, that's fine. But you know, there are lots of opinions within the rabbinic Talmud, within the corpus of rabbinic law. And we've been following opinion A, and that's been good for us until now, but we want to kind of divert the train from opinion A to opinion B, because opinion B works much better for what we need right now. So I'm not saying scrap that rabbinic law. I'm saying, look, it built into this body of law are different options, are different opinions. Let's just switch track to this opinion. Why not do that? That's box number three. And we'll see, I think you can do that today. You just have to have the right people doing it, and we'll talk about that. And box number four is someone who comes along and says, you know something, I don't want to change the written law. I don't want to change the rabbinic law. I don't want to even reroute the rabbinic law onto a different path. I just want to do something which is completely halachically neutral, but no one ever did before. No one ever did this, because no one ever thought of this. Or someone else came up with this, and there's no halachic problem with it. Why can't we do it? Just because we never did it before. A good example of that might be, let's say, a bat mitzvah service for a young woman, for a girl at 12. Now, bat mitzvah was not an orthodox custom. It was created in the reform movement in Germany in the 19th century, and then Mordechai Kaplan, who created the Reconstructionist, had a very famous bat mitzvah for his daughter in America in the 1920s. And it's caught on in the Orthodox world over the last 30, 40 years. I'm sure many of you in this room either had bat mitzvah or some kind of bat mitzvah celebration, or made one for your children or grandchildren, etc. There's no halachic reason why not, but we never did it before. Should we be doing stuff now which is new, which we're even copying from, let's say, from the reform movement? But it's a great idea. You know, they have great ideas. So let's do it. Why not? That's the fourth box. Okay? So they are the four boxes I want to talk about tonight. And I'm going to spend more time on three and four because they're the interesting ones. But I'm going to try and do one and two in quite sort of short measure. Okay? Everybody with me? That's what I'd like to do today. I hope that's going to be helpful. Okay, so box one is actually really easy. Can we change the Torah? And the answer is no, we can't. And the Torah is very clear on that. Let's look at a Rambam in number three. I brought all the sources in the sheet in Hebrew and English. You can follow me whichever you want. Some of them I'll even read in English just to be quick. He says, Davo Boro, says Maimonides, in Hilchot Yesodei HaTorah, which is his introductory laws of how halacha works and how the Jewish system works. Davar Barur Mufarash V'Torah, it's absolutely clear and explicit in the Torah. Source number three, Shehi Mitzvah Omedet Le'olam Uliyomei Olamim, that this mitzvah, the mitzvah in the Torah, will be forever and ever and ever. You know, he's not paid by the word. He doesn't have to say Le'olam Uliyomei Olamim. He just wants to hit it home. Ein la lo shinui, you can't change it. Lo girayim, you can't take away from it. Lo tosefet, you can't add to it. As it says, Shene'emar, et kol davar asher anochi mitzvah etzchem otod tishmaru la'asot. Says the Torah, you must do what I'm telling you. Lo tosef alav, don't add to it. Lo tigra vimenu, and don't take away from it. And he goes on the rest of that. The Rambam's opinion, Maimonides' approach is, as long as Jews are alive, they have to keep the Torah. Even when Mashiach comes, says the Rambam, no change in the Torah. There will be changed circumstances which will open up new possibilities, yes. But the Torah remains the Torah. Even, he says, when the resurrection happens and the dead come to life, if you're alive, the same Torah, 613 mitzvahs. The only time that a person is released, he says, from the 613 mitzvot, is when, after 120 years, we go to the next world. You don't need any mitzvahs in the next world. It's a non-physical world. There's no need for a Torah. There's no mitzvahs there. But while we're alive in this world, with Mashiach, before Mashiach, after Mashiach, we still keep the same Torah. Okay? So the Rambam's view is there will never be another Torah. Even if God says, you know, let's go to a new hill, let's go to, Bushi or something like that, and gather together the Jewish people and give the Torah. No, says the Rambam, not happening. Even in Monsey, even in Brooklyn, okay? Even in Yerushalayim, it's not happening, no new Torah. Having said that, there is a Kabbalistic approach which is different from the Maimonidean one, and I put that on page 2. If you just look on page 2, there is a statement in the Gemara which says, Amar Rav Yosef Zot Omeret Mitzvot Betelot La'atid Lavo. That in the future, the mitzvot will be cancelled. Now, the Rambam understands Maimonides, the future means the future in heaven, in the Olam Haba, when there is no physical. No. The Kabbalists say no. When Mashiach comes, all bets are off. Because the messianic world for the mystics, non-rationalists, non-Maimonideans, is a world which is completely different from this world. It's physically completely different. All the rules of nature change, all the miraculous nature of the time. And of course there'll be no Torah in the way we know Torah today. You know, Adam and Eve and Adam and Chava in the Garden of Eden didn't need 613 mitzvot. So when we're back to that state, we won't need them either. And therefore, all bets are off. Okay, good, great. But right now, I think you and I can all agree we're not living in the Messianic age. Certainly doesn't feel like it. Okay, and therefore, even if you go with the mystics, it's not relevant. So if someone wants to come along today and say, I don't like pigs being draped, I want them to be kosher, or if any question really involves fundamentally overruling a Torah mitzvah, it's just not happening, it's just not possible. So for example, if you say there's a major challenge with women who are agunot, which there is in many ways, let's just flip it so that either a man can give a divorce to a woman, or a woman can give a divorce to a man. That's just not possible, because the Torah is explicit on this issue. It doesn't work the other way around. Now you can say, okay, what can we do to try and encourage, da, da, da. That's fine, and we should. But to just say, well, just flip it, it's just not an option, any more than making pork kosher or Shabbos on Tuesday. So if what you're dealing with, and you have to sometimes analyze this, is what I'm asking a fundamental change of a Torah mitzvah, then that's not going to be possible. Now, interpretation is, but a flip, that's not. Okay, so that's box one. And sometimes questions people ask actually go to this point. They're actually Torah mitzvahs. They maybe didn't realize. And once they see it's a Torah mitzvah, okay, so there's really no flexibility. The second box. What about if I want to change something which is a rabbinic law? I say, you know something? I don't like minyan being 10 men. I want it to be 5 men and 5 women. I don't like second day Yom Tov. Everyone has a gripe about second day Yom Tov, right? Why do we keep second day Yom Tov? Many people mistakenly ask the question, well, now that we have a fixed calendar, we know which day is the right day, why do we keep on doing stuff as if we didn't know which was the right day? Which actually is the wrong question, because even in the time of the Talmud, when they set this second day Yom Tov, they also had a fixed calendar, and they also knew which is the right day, but nevertheless said, but you still have to keep second day Yom Tov if you live outside Israel. Okay, good. So let's say we want to scrap that. Can we scrap that today? Can we scrap any of these rabbinic laws? And the answer is, what do we need in order to override or overturn fixed rabbinic law? And the answer is?
Sanhedrin.
A Sanhedrin. We need a new Sanhedrin. The Sanhedrin is the Jewish Supreme Court of 71. Used to be men. Let's assume it'll be men, but it might not be, because whether women can sit on the Sanhedrin is actually a more open question than you think. That's not what I'm talking about right now. We'll see when we get there. But we could have a Sanhedrin today. There have been bona fide attempts within the Orthodox world for the last 1,000 years to reformulate the Sanhedrin. The most famous one being in the 16th century in Sfat, when Rav Yosef Karo and Rav Yaakov Beirav and Rav Moshe Alshich, they got together and they said, we are going to restart a Sanhedrin. And I brought you here a number of different points here. That in number 5 and number 6, you'll see that the Sanhedrin had a lot of power to override a previous Sanhedrin. There is a mitzvah in the Torah, two mitzvot of the 613, to follow what the Sanhedrin say. meaning the authority of the Sanhedrin, and the Gemara, by the way, the Talmud is an extension of the Sanhedrin. The reason that we got a Talmud is because we lost the Sanhedrin. You might ask, why did we never need a Talmud before? Why did they never write a second one, like 1,000 years later? The answer is, we only needed one because it replaced the Sanhedrin. The Sanhedrin basically fell apart, partly because of Jewish, you know, rebellion against it, and they didn't follow it, and partly because the Romans just cut it down, and then eventually the Christians disbanded it, the Byzantine Romans disbanded it and killed the last president and said, no more Sanhedrin. So we don't have one. So what do we need if we don't have a Sanhedrin? We need a replacement, which was the Talmud, which is actually fascinating because a Sanhedrin was a group of living, breathing rabbis arguing with each other across generations, changing each other's view on different things. And that's what the Talmud is meant to be. That's why the Talmud looks like it looks. It's a completely unique work, human work, because it's meant to represent thousands of rabbis talking to each other across generations, because it replaces the Sanhedrin. It's not just an account of what people said at a certain point. It's a synthesized document to replace the Sanhedrin. And it's brilliant. There are things in the Talmud which, you know, often just lay dormant until technology somehow catches up with them. There are discussions in the Talmud about it re-implanting embryos from one animal into another animal, and which is considered the mother? Is it the donor? Is it the surrogate who holds the embryo? Is it the genetic mother who gave the original embryo? Is it not? And these are all discussions in the Gemara. Even to the Gemara and Talmud are the same thing, effectively. Even to the point on that particular Talmudic discussion that later commentators, in this particular case Tosafos, say, why on earth do the rabbis have nothing better to do in the Talmud than ask completely theoretical questions? In the Middle Ages, they say nobody can take an embryo from one mother and re-implant it in another one. Why would they even discuss that? So the Talmud discusses things which, for us, become very helpful, useful, active. So it's an unbelievably flexible. There are things there that you can find. But it's not the same as the Sanhedrin. If we had that actual group of people, then they really could reopen the Sanhedrin, the Talmud. One of the axiomatic elements of the Talmud and the halakhic system, if you look here in number 7, you can look at 5 and 6 yourself, that's the Rambam talking about how the Sanhedrin works. And as I say, the Torah gives us a mitzvah to follow that Sanhedrin. They can't give themselves the authority, the Torah gives them the authority. Look at number 7, he says, Rebbe v'Rebbe Nosson, so if Mishnah, Rebbe and Rebbe Nosson, who put together the Mishnah, was the end of that period. And Rav Ashi v'Ravina sof hara'af. Rav Ashi and Ravina, who represent the basic ceiling of the Talmud, at the end of psak, at the end of ruling. What does that mean? If you look here, number 9, look at this source from the Rambam. Once all the sages had died, of whom the last were Ravina and Rav Ashi, the Talmud had already been completed. So the goal of all who came after them was only to understand the words they write. We do not add or subtract from it, i.e. from the Talmud. So you can't argue with the Talmud right now. None of us can. It's sealed. And no halakhic authority from the time of the Talmud onwards, whether they're Sephardic or Ashkenazic, has just gone face-to-face with the Talmud and say, yes, you say that, but we don't say that anymore. Now, you can interpret, and you can work within it and say, well, you know, proving from the way that you argue it, this is what the Talmudic answer is. For example, the Talmud says very clearly that milk, which is milked by a non-Jewish person from a non-Jewish kosher animal, is not kosher on a rabbinic level. On a Torah level, of course it's kosher. If it comes from a cow, it's kosher. If it comes from a camel, it's not. But on a rabbinic level, if a non-Jew milks a cow, you can't guarantee that that milk wouldn't have been adulterated. Maybe they threw in some horse milk or some camel milk because they needed to make up the quantities, and then it becomes treif. Unless a Jew was supervising, that milk is not kosher on a rabbinic level. Now, when the 20th century poskim, when Rav Moshe Feinstein comes along and says, well, what about the status of milk today? He can't just argue with the Talmud and say, ah, that was 2,000 years ago. Today we don't mind. Non-Jews can milk animals and it's fine. He can't say that. He can't argue with the Talmud in that way. But what he can say is the milk that we have today in Western regulated countries is sufficiently supervised in lots of other ways that this effectively ticks all the boxes for what the rabbis required when they required supervised milk. And if the rabbis were around today from the Sanhedrin or from the Gemara, they would look at the milk produced by the, you know, regular non-Jewish dairies and say, yes, that's fine. He's not arguing. He's not saying, oh, it's fine if non-Jews make milk. He's saying that the milk they make today is as good as the supervised version. And you can't fake what... I mean, he doesn't just say that. He has like 30, 40 pages proving it. You can't fake being a major poisek of our time. You know, you read what their essays are and their arguments are, and you can see for yourself. So we can't argue with the Sanhedrin. We can interpret, or with the Gemara we can interpret, but we could have another Sanhedrin. There were attempts to make one. Why don't we have a Sanhedrin today? You tell me. Why don't we have a Sanhedrin 2026?
Nobody feels competent that they have the inspiration to...
I don't know. I know some pretty competent feeling rabbis that
conflicting opinions.
Okay, but why? Okay, they're conflicting. They're always conflicting opinions. Why don't we have a Sanhedrin today? They were always competent people. They still are. And you only get the people of your time. Okay, we don't have the same competence as 500 years ago. It doesn't matter. Built into those verses that say, listen to the Sanhedrin, it says in the Torah, it says the Sanhedrin of your time. And if you turn around and say, yeah, well, these guys today aren't as good as they used to be, doesn't matter. They're the ones you've got. So why don't we have one? And the answer is, because we can't get our act together. That's why. We can't get enough people to agree on who would be on the Sanhedrin to make the Sanhedrin. The Rambam says that with the Sanhedrin, you need an unbroken chain of smicha, the original smicha, ordination from rabbi to student to student. So what are we going to do? It's lost. And if you're going to wait for someone to walk out of the woods and say, I've been receiving smicha in an unbroken chain for the last 1,000 years and nobody's noticed. Okay, well, that's not going to happen. We don't think that's going to happen. So the Rambam says, no, it's fine. If you could just get the rabbis of Israel, because the Sanhedrin has to be in Israel, to agree on a candidate, one candidate, they can seed the new Sanhedrin, and then they can give smichat a new, and then, hey presto, you have a Sanhedrin. All we need is for people to get together. It doesn't have to be every person. A good consensus of rabbinic opinion in Israel that this person has the smicha, and we're good to go. And then we could change all sorts of things.
Isn't that an oxymoron?
Why?
A consensus of rabbinic law.
Actually not true. It's not an oxymoron because most principles of rabbinic law are agreed upon. I know that we say, oh, 5 Jews, 15 opinions and all that kind of stuff. It's not true. Most halakhic issues are unanimous. Unanimous. We focus on details that no other religion really even cares about. You ask a nice Christian person, a Buddhist, to light a candle, they're happy. They go, they light a candle, they did a mitzvah, everybody's happy. You ask Jews to light Shabbos candles, there's a whole chapter of Talmud on what kind of candles, what kind of wicks, what kind of this, what kind of oil. No one else cares about those questions. We care about those questions, so of course we disagree on the detail, but the fundamentals we don't disagree on. We really don't. Jews are actually quite good at consensus. We just argue about stuff that nobody else cares about. Okay, we do have our problems, but we could get our act together. If you want to cry about something next to Shabbat, and not being able to bring sacrifices in the temple and throw blood around doesn't really bother you, and you don't want to cry about that, and some people feel less unhappy that we don't have that, and some people feel more. So just cry about the fact that we can't get our act together, get a Sanhedrin in place, and then we could reopen lots of things, reopen lots of questions legitimately. Now, I don't know what the Sanhedrin would do, I don't know what they should do, but I know they could do a lot. Okay? So, box number two, I want to change a fundamental rabbinic law. We just want to get our act together, get a Sanhedrin, and then we can talk from there. There is a group of people today that call themselves the Sanhedrin. That's nice, but they don't have the support of the people. The Sanhedrin relies on the grassroots. They're not an autocracy. We support them. If we don't support them, they don't exist. They're not even allowed to create a law which the people don't want to keep. It's very sort of, what's the word, symbiotic. They need the people need them. It's a very, it's not democratic in that sense, but it's very much dependent on that relationship. So, yes, let's get a Sanhedrin, then we can open up box number two, we can change stuff. And you'd be surprised how much stuff people say, why can't we do that, that we could if we just had a Sanhedrin. Okay? Fine. That's box number two. Box number three. We don't want to change a rabbinic law, certainly not a Torah law, but we want to change track. So, what does that mean, change track? So, let me give you an interesting example. Changing track would be things of the following type. Let's say it's not clear in the Talmud that women cannot wear tefillin. It's not clear. There are different views. There are clearly some women who did wear tefillin. And there are other views that say this is very strongly discouraged for women to wear tefillin. Tzitzit is a different thing. The Talmud seems to be quite open to women wearing tzitzit. If they want to wear tzitzit, that's not a question for them. But tefillin, someone comes along and says, you know something, There are lots of women today who want to wear tefillin, let's say. I'm not even sure that's true, but let's say that there is a group of women who want to wear tefillin. And they're very, you know, serious about it, and they're very authentic about it, and they're doing it for all the right reasons. So let's just change to the other opinion that would be more open to wearing, women wearing tefillin, and then everybody's happy. Well, not everybody's happy, but they're happy. And they're following that opinion. Can we do that? There was a very controversial ruling about 15 years ago. I brought some stuff on it on the sheet in a school, in a modern Orthodox school in America, where there were a group of girls who were in the school from more, you know, conservative type homes. I didn't mention conservative in a minute. I will. Sorry, I forgot that in box two. And they said, we want to wear tefillin. And the rabbi of the school said, you know something? It's not the end of the world. There are opinions to rely on. And he said, okay, we're going to have women who can wear tefillin in our school. We've got to rely on that opinion. And it triggered an unholy, you know, whatever. Like, you can't do that. You can't make that call. It's not possible. Women have been not wearing tefillin for the last 1,400 years or whatever. You can't start that now. Da, 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 da. And say, but look, there's an opinion. It doesn't matter. And what I want to suggest to you for box three is that you can reroute the train. But the people that can do that are the people who take responsibility for the system as a whole. Not your community rabbi, not your rabbi in a school. It's too big a change for you to kind of do that on your own. And therefore, I want to suggest to you, and I brought you various sources on this, a senior posek. And I suppose we all know posek in terms of like a halakhic guide for the community, for that community. We all know who they are. Okay, we have our own communities, but no one really disagrees on who the top people are. Nobody says, oh, well, your senior people are really rubbish. You know, our senior people are the... I mean, ignorant people say things like that, but that's just silly. So the senior people in each community, the senior poskim, they have that ability to make that call. But I don't think the junior ones do. Let me give you another example where this actually happened. It's very clear from the Talmud, from the Rambam, from the Shulchan Aruch, that we are not happy, halakhically, teaching Torah to women. It's very clear. Even though there are other opinions that say, no, you absolutely have to teach women. Rabbi Eliezer in the Talmud says, you know something? It always goes wrong. It's not successful. Don't teach Torah to women. They'll get it all wrong. They'll mess it all up. And it's going to lead to, you know, bad places. Okay, the Rambam rules that way. He says, if you teach Gemara to women, then oy va'avoy, it's going to go all awry. And he gives a reason. He says, because the majority of women do not have the Talmudic training to be able to analyze that properly, and they're going to mix it all up. And don't forget, back in the day, they had no halacha books. You couldn't look things up in a halacha sefer. The only way you got halacha is by learning the Talmud. If you're going to teach it in a half-baked way to people who don't understand it, they're going to get it all wrong. They're going to eat chometz on Pesach, and they're going to eat treif, and they're going to break Shabbos. Da, 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 da. Okay, fine. The Rambam brings that, and he says, you know what? Chumash, Tanakh, best not doing that either, okay? Because they're going to mess that up. Okay, it's not as bad. So you learn Tanakh and you mess it all up and you think David HaMelech is Avraham Avinu's uncle. And, you know, whatever you come up, at least you're not going to eat comets on Pesach. You know, but it's not good. So don't teach Torah. Fine. The Shulchan Aruch just repeats that. Shulchan Aruch says, teaching Torah to women is a bad idea. He doesn't technically use the word asur. But he says, Tzivu Chachamim, the rabbi said, don't do that. Comes along Sara Schneira in the 1920s, and says, you know something? This is a disaster happening in front of our very eyes. In Western Europe in the late 1800s, Rav Hirsch already introduced women's Torah learning. But you know something? Those German Jews, they're very modern. They're very Western. They're very, you know, but it's not happening in Poland. It's not happening in Lithuania. Sara Schneira looked around and said, excuse me, these young women are going to high schools in Poland. They're going to universities in Poland. They're coming out with postgraduate degrees in biochemistry in the 1920s in Poland. And in Jewish studies, you talk to them like they're three-year-olds. Well, they're clearly just going to check out. And they did check out. The women just checked out. They don't want to be talked to like three-year-olds. So she says, you have to teach Torah to women. You have to.
Bet Yaakov.
Now, fine. So she can scream and shout, you have to teach Torah to women. But, you know, if the Shulchan Aruch doesn't say that, and the Rambam doesn't say that, and the Gemara seems to... So what? No one's going to listen to her. How did the Beis Yaakov system take off, which was radical, radical? And by the way, there were still rabbis in the 1970s saying, you can't send your daughter to a Beis Yaakov. It's against the Shulchan Aruch. It's against the Rambam. It's again, Rav Ozner says this, and he's right. It is. Why is it okay? Because the Chofetz Chaim backed Sarah Shneira. Now, she didn't ask his permission before she set up the school system, in fairness. She got a bracha from her own Rebbe, but she needed the Chofetz Chaim. The Chofetz Chaim writes in the 1920s, 30s, that I am being approached by fathers of daughters, saying, am I allowed to send my daughters to this modernish, you know, radical school system where they're teaching the women Torah, you know? And he's, isn't it against the Shulchan Aruch? And the Chofetz Chaim says, not just it's allowed, but it's a great mitzvah. Whoa, it's a great mitzvah? To do something that the Shulchan Aruch and the Rambam say is probably prohibited? How did that happen? Whoa, that's halachic change on steroids. The answer is, it's box three. It's not box one. It doesn't say in the Torah you can't teach Torah to women. It's not box two. It's not unequivocal in the rabbis prohibited. It's Rabbi Lezer's opinion. This is the opinion we followed. Okay, so now we're not going to follow that opinion. We're going to follow a different opinion. Even within that opinion, the Rambam is very clear when he says, don't teach Torah to women. He says, because the majority of women don't have the framework, educational framework, to deal with it. Well, now, the majority of women do have the educational framework to teach with it. So even with that, to learn it, so even within that paradigm, you could probably, and the Chofetz Chaim says, absolutely, you must. And now we do. And now Beis Yaakov seems like the most right-wing, traditionally, and if anyone ever comes up to you and says, women are not allowed to learn Gemara, first of all, that's fake news. It doesn't say that anywhere. It says that you shouldn't teach women Gemara, and it also says you shouldn't teach women Chumash. Certainly not with Rashi. Rashi, Ramban, I mean, that's oral law. That's like full on. So the world has changed. And so you're going to turn around and say, well, if you can change that, why can't you change that? And the answer might be, well, excuse me, this is box three and this is box two. Box three, you can change. You just need to reread. You just need a big person. If the Chofetz Chaim or whoever today turned around and said, if the senior poskim, if Rav Herschel Schechter, who is down the road now in YU, turned around and said, you know something, guys? It's time that women started wearing tefillin. Now, he's not going to say that, because he came out very, very, very strongly against that in 15 years ago, and I brought you some of his writing there. Then that's good enough for me. What about partnership minyan? What about giving women aliyot? So I think giving women aliyot in shul is probably a box three. It might be a box two, but it's probably a box three. There seem to be different approaches to this, okay? And if a senior posek in our community, even if the other communities say, no, we don't agree, fine, I don't care. This is my community, this is my senior person, and they've said it's, if they say it's good, I'm in, I'm fine. The problem, in my opinion, and this is just my opinion, the problem with the partnership minyan movement is that no senior person has come along and said that this is okay. And the people who've said it's okay are, you know, great, you know, wonderful local Talmidei Chachamim, and fine, they have their opinion, but you can't reroute the train in that way. Imagine that we suddenly turn around and say, you know, we should have all our tefillahs now in English, because Hebrew is just very, you know, stressful for people. Just put everything in the scrap Hebrew, do it all in English. That is halakhically not such a major change, but I don't think anyone could do that unless they were a very senior person. Just so they can throw all the Sidurim away, we'll pray everything in English. Not such a big change, but nevertheless, I think you need someone senior to do this. And I've suggested to you here the difference between the senior and the Jewish people and the junior people. The senior people have responsibility that the junior people don't. There are also halachic values. It's not just technical. You know, when as a teacher, I've had this for many years. When someone sticks up their hand and starts a question with the word, technically, you know what's coming. What's coming is something that they know is not right. But they've got a, you know, Gemara kopf, and they've like, oh yeah, well, if you do this and you do that and you do this and you do that and you do this. It's not just halakhic details. There's halakhic, there are halakhic values and ethics, and they can go in both directions. Just let me look at one with you for a second. Turn over to page number five. Turn over to page number five. So this is a very interesting one. In number 15, source number 15, so the Gemara says here as follows, very interesting case. Pam acha, it happened once, says the Gemara. Source number 15, page 5. Haya lanu eger, we had a calf, shel zifre shlamim, that was a shlamim offering, which a family brought a shlamim offering for a good reason, because they wanted to celebrate something, they wanted to celebrate a simcha or something like that, they bring a shlamim to the temple. And they took it into the Ezrat Nashim, a very big courtyard towards the, you know, temple, the sort of back end of the temple area was called the Ezrat Nashim. It wasn't just women, by the way, it was women and men together. But the Ezrat Yisrael is where they did all the you know, the offering, you know, heavy work. This was no, there were no women in that section. But they took it into the women's section. Why? Lo mipnei smicha v'samcho alav nashim. And the women did smicha. Part of the offering service was the people put their hands on the offering. It was like a transferal. Meaning, I just want to go up and smoke and give God a big hug because I'm so excited with life. Or if it was a chatat, meaning I've done something terribly wrong and I feel like I should go up and smoke, but we don't do that because we're not into human sacrifice. So this animal will go instead of me and I'll like transfer myself. Smicha was a very big thing. But women are not obligated in smicha for this particular, the laying of the hands on the animal. So they took it to the women's courtyard. Lo mipnei shesmicha b'nashim. Not because we, this view said that women had to do that. Because the women were complaining. The women were unhappy. They were saying, this is our family sacrifice, and the guys are doing all the smicha, and why can't we do smicha? So they said, you know something, why should we upset people more than we need to? Let's take it in. It is a halachic value that we don't want sections of the Jewish people to feel disenfranchised. That is a real halachic value, especially when it comes to women. There are other halachic values that we don't, for example, want to do things that people will confuse with sectarian, non-orthodox, whatever we want, how we define that, movements. I brought you also on the sheet, which is a little bit later. You can, a lot of this stuff in English you can read. It's all about halakhic values. But I brought you a source towards the end where they say that shechita, if you want to shecht an animal, so there's no rules as to what you shecht into. You shecht on the ground, you shecht into a bowl, you shecht into a pit, do whatever you like. But the Gemara says, once the Sadducees started insisting that you had to shecht into a pit, now we can't do that. Why? Because there's this blurring, things are not clear. And if you start doing that, people will assume that you've, you know, taken on a sectarian approach, and we don't want to cause confusion. That's a halachic value. Now, who's going to make that call? Anyone can say, well, it's the thin end of the wedge. If you let them do this, they'll end up doing that. That's just an argument for not doing anything. So someone's got to make that call. So I want to argue in box number 3, yes, someone can make that call, but they have to be a senior person. Because a senior person has that sense of a responsibility, has that sense of overall view, and there are, you know, different things that fit into box 3. I gave you a couple of other examples there that we talked a little bit about, but I want to suggest that that's box 3, and that can happen, and that might happen in all sorts of ways. Fine. Let's just talk about box 4, and then I'll open to some questions, because I'm sure you have questions. This, in many ways, is the most interesting, because this is where there is no real halachic problem. You're just finding problems. There are no problems. We never did it before. Do we have a problem doing new things? A lot of people do have a problem doing new things. So I want to suggest to you a way to look at this. I brought you some examples here. Bat mitzvah, we talked about. Women dancing with a sefer Torah on Simchas Torah. So we never used to do that. We never used to have men dancing with a Sefer Torah either, by the way. And that is also halakhically somewhat questionable to have Sifrei Torah suddenly schlepped out of the Aron Kodesh and, you know, danced around the shul. That is not the way it used to be. It used to be that they put a Sefer Torah in the middle and people danced around the Sefer Torah. Men danced around the Sefer Torah, women danced around the Sefer, but no one danced with the Sefer Torah. Okay, so now we're schlepping the Sefer Torah around, which is not so straightforward. Even when we take the Sefer Torah around the shul on a regular Shabbat or whenever, you're not really meant to take the Sefer Torah all around the houses. You know, here, there, he wants to kiss it, and he wants to kiss it, and he wants... You're meant to just take it to the bimah and finish. If you want to kiss the Sefer, you go to that. It doesn't come to you. So now we're going to turn around and say, well, you know something, we're clearly not strict on that. We take around the Sefer Torah, so let's take it through the women's section as well. The women who want to kiss the Sefer Torah. If already you're taking around the men, and you're okay with that, what difference does it make if you take around the women? Oh yeah, but we never did that before. That looks, fill in your word, whatever you think is not orthodox. Okay? So are we going to do that? Or are we not going to do that? I brought you some other examples here as well. Women voting was a very interesting one. If you look in the original analysis halachically of this. Oh, by the way, there's a good number 3 as well, which is very relevant to here. Before we get into box number 4, I forgot box number 3. A very good one is women's communal leadership. Mm. Are you allowed to have women who are in charge of the community? So there is a real halachic question of something called Sarara. There is a Rambam, that clearly says that just like the king had to be a king and not a queen, there's no such thing as a Jewish queen. The queen, maybe the person married to the king, you can have a Camilla in Halacha, but you can't have a Queen Elizabeth in Halacha. Okay? You have to have a king. Says the Rambam, just like you have to have a king, so any leadership position within the community has to be a man and not a woman. Now, many of the traditional authorities argue with this. Many. Where does that come from? And what about Devorah? And there are examples left, right, and centre where this is not clearly the case. For years and years and years, decades and centuries, we followed the position that men and not women, the Rambam's position, could be leaders of the community. So is it possible now, within the United Synagogue, let's say, for a woman to be the president of a community?
Yes.
Yes. Is that a recent change?
Yes. Fairly recent.
Yes, fairly recent. Who made that change?
United Synagogue.
Correct. The London-based Inn with the United Synagogue. Mm. And I want to suggest to you that's a perfect example of a box three. Even though I've gone into box four, but let's just, before I forgot it. Because there you have halacha, which is clearly following a certain path. There is another option, which we didn't follow. People at the top of the chain can say, you know something? Higiyazman. It's time to change the train tracks. And that's what the London-based Inn did. They said, you know, up until now we haven't had women in charge of the community, but now it's time we can follow the other opinion. Great. Now you turn around and say, well, look at it. If they can do that, because we nudged them, they could do this, they could do this, they could do this. No. They can't necessarily do all these other things. They can do a box three. They are the people in charge. They can change the route into another opinion. Fine. They can't just make pigs kosher and they can't just get away with, you know, scraps like a day onto.
Can I make a very quick comment on
that? Yes, of course you can.
When I first joined the board of Shul, women were not allowed to vote.
Right.
And as it so happened, we had a very understanding chair.
Yes.
And he found a way around this by getting an indicative vote first.
Okay.
A few years later, women were allowed to vote and they were allowed to be actually members of the board.
Yes.
A few years later, women were allowed to do this and there were more, and I became the first woman vice chair in the United Synagogue.
You heard it here, ladies and gentlemen. Mm. Okay.
That took approximately 20 years.
Right.
My grandchildren, the girls, will not wait the 20 years.
Okay, well, that's a good question. I don't really know what the world's going to look like in 2040, 2050. I can't even imagine it. And I'm not sure. Things tend to be in cycles. Things might even become more conservative, little c, as the world goes on, not necessarily more liberal. I don't know. But that's a very good example of this same issue of women's control and leadership of the community, which is what voting is. It's controlling the community, being passed over to women because we're taking a different view, which is one we never took before. Let's just talk about box four and then we'll finish and open to questions. So I've brought you on the sheet a quite extensive quote from the Sri Dei Eish, Rav Yaakov Yechiel Weinberg, on the issue of bat mitzvah. He was asked in the 1950s, 60s, what about bat mitzvah when it's a reform idea? And he says as follows. Let's look in English in number 22 for a second. You can read the Hebrew later on. There are those, he says, who argue against permitting bat mitzvah celebrations, page 7 of the bottom, because they deviate from the practice of previous generations who never did such things. But in truth, this is not an argument, he says. We never did it before is not an argument. For in previous generations, there was not a need to be involved with the education of girls because every Jewish home was full of Torah and the fear of heaven and the atmosphere of every Jewish town was filled with the fragrance and spirit of Judaism. Okay, that's a little bit rose-tinted. It wasn't quite that, you know, wonderful in the natural either. But it's true to say that girls who grew up in a Jewish home absorbed into themselves the spirit of Judaism without any active steps, almost as if it took it in with its mother's milk. And that is true, because education used to be mimetic. People used to just follow what they saw in the home. They didn't learn it in books. There's a very important article which everybody has to read. Professor Chaim Soloveitchik wrote about 27 years ago an article called Rupture and Reconstruction, as to why the Jewish world moved in the 20th century from a much more pick-it-up-in-the-home, mimetic kind of, you don't need it to be taught to you directly, to a, well, no, we don't have that anymore, we have to learn it all in books, and that's why Judaism looks like it looks today in the Orthodox world. You must read the article, it's very, very important. So he says, we didn't used to need this, but then he says, but now things have changed greatly. The influence of the street has uprooted any attachment to Judaism from the hearts of young people. Girls are educated in non-Jewish and non-religious schools, which make no effort to implant within the hearts of their students a love of Torah and the holy practice of authentic Judaism. Now we must therefore focus our energies on girls' education. And he goes on to say the same kind of idea that Sarah Schneer has said, which is that it's terrible when girls are getting an education to a high level in secular studies, but in Jewish studies we're treating them like primary school children. We can't have that. Then he says in the next paragraph, clear logic and the principles of education virtually require equal celebration for a girl when she reaches the age of responsibility for mitzvot. The difference which is made in the celebration for a boy and a girl upon attaining maturity makes a very hurtful impression in the feelings of a maturing girl who in all other areas has attained equality. The word he uses in Hebrew is emancipatia. Mm-hmm. Emancipatia. You feel like he's like Che Guevara, you know? This is a very orthodox rabbi saying that women are emancipated in other areas of life. You cannot deny them a Jewish experience at bat mitzvah. It's completely counterproductive. Then just go over to the last page. And he says, but I give you a litmus test. How do I know when it's like not legit? Lots of people want to burn down the system in the name of emancipation. They're not going to help you rebuild it. When are we not going to do that? In practice, he says, the matter depends on the motivation and intentions of those people who wish to innovate new customs, such as bat mitzvah celebrations. Are their intentions l'shem shamayim, for the sake of heaven, or God forbid, just to imitate the non-orthodox? So what he's testing there is, what is your agenda? Is your agenda to help the education of young Jewish women connect to Torah? Or is your agenda another agenda? You have an egalitarian agenda or whatever. You can define these. If you have a what he considers a negative agenda, then he says, I don't think we should be so quick to change things, even if they're halakhically neutral. But if your agenda is positive, then, you know, why would you say no? It's very hard because people have different agendas. People themselves have many agendas within their own minds. I once had a discussion with a woman in the United Synagogue, and she wanted to redesign the machitzas in the shul. And, okay, that's fine. You know, it's fine. Some people didn't ever want to change machitzas. But other shuls have said, no, you know, you'll put things on the bottom floor, you'll have the women more connected. So she said, maybe we could put the machitza like this. And I said, yeah, well, maybe that would work. I'm not giving up sack, but I was discussing it with her. She said, well, what about if we did it like this? So I said, well, I don't know, maybe. And I said, well, you know, if you think the rabbi is so accommodating, you know, maybe you can get rid of the machitza completely. And she said to me, not yet. Okay, so is that just a comment? Is that an agenda? Is that she really wants no machitzas, or is that just what you say? It's hard. And people have said to me, it's not fair. You never ask men what their agendas are. You only ever ask women when they... It's not true. He said, you ask anyone who wants to change, what's your agenda? And maybe it's positive, and maybe it's not. But he says at the end, I'm aware that people don't want to change anything because they're very traditional. And then he says at the end, nevertheless, these people should not forget that the hearts of those who seek to permit this new custom of celebrating bat mitzvah beat with concern for the religious education of Jewish girls, who due to circumstances of life in this generation are in the greatest need of spiritual and ethical support and encouragement when they arrive at the age of bat mitzvah. So he said, they're well-agendered, well-motivated. It's something we need to do and something we must do. Okay, he's not going to call the girls up to read from the Sefer Torah. He's going to give them a proper celebration in the community that we can make them feel that they're just as valued as their brothers when they reach the age of maturity. So that's, I think, is a good example for. And there are things that we do like that. I think, for example, you know, taking the Sefer Torah around the women's section of the community. I don't think that needs the Gadol Hador to make that call. I don't think you need the senior posek in the whole community, because it's not really a halakhically problematic issue. You need the rather the community working with the community to decide whether this is something they want to do or not. Okay? I think the rabbi has to be involved. You can't just have people doing what they like. It's funny, you know, maybe it's not funny. In our shul in Har Nof in Jerusalem, so for many years they had no women's dancing with the Sefer Torah. And then a group of women, interestingly more from the American Olim, said, we know we have to change this, we really have to. And they lobbied and lobbied, and eventually the Rav turned around and said, okay, this year we're going to have women's dancing with the Sefer Torah. There was a revolution, a rebellion by the people. Who rebelled against this?
Women.
Women, not the men. The men is like, whatever you want, do whatever you want. Give us an easy life, fine. The women, the Israeli women, these are Dati Lumi women, these are religious Zionist women who are seen as progressive in some ways. We don't want that. That looks reform. That looks like, that's not us. We didn't come to our shul to have this. Blah, 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 blah. And the rabbi didn't know what to do. Because one group of people says they want the change, one group that says they don't want the change. So he did what I think I might have wanted to do, which is, you know something? For the next 3 months, we're going to have shiurim and discussion groups on this issue. We're going to look at all the sources, and then at the end of that, we're going to have a vote. And they did that, and they had a vote, and it was exactly even 50-50. Okay, exactly. Who had the casting vote? I think the Rav should have the casting vote. Now, in the shul that we have in Alon Shul, where we live now, the women have a Sefer Torah. They have women's dancing with a Sefer Torah, women's dancing without a Sefer Torah, and women watching from the balcony. Okay, whatever you like.
Yeah.
You pick your poison. You know, you do whatever. But I think that that's a good example of a box number four where there's really no halakhic problem, but you have to, you know, find out why people want to do it and make sure it, you know, it goes in the right direction. So that's what I want to propose to you. If you can think of things that you want to change, and you can work out which box they go in. Box number one, which we're not going to change. Box number two, which we could maybe when you get a Sanhedrin, and let's work on it and get our act together. Box number three, where we can lobby. We can lobby. And there I think Blue Greenberg is right. You know, where there's a rabbinic will, where the rabbis decide, then maybe we can change box three. And maybe we should represent to our senior people, we really feel that we need this. Okay? Maybe that's possible. And then box four, where there's nothing really wrong with it. It's just new. There has to be, you know, rabbinic consensus in the community, etc. But I don't think you need to, you know, invoke the whole system in order to make that change. That's my suggestion. Maybe prenuptial agreements is a box number four, actually. I don't think that it's a major... And even if it is a box number three, the senior people can make that call. And in some communities have made that call. Mm. Although not all prenuptial agreements are born equal, and they do work differently. Prenuptial agreement in London, is it from the one in America? Okay, fine. Okay, that's my thesis. Do with it what you like. Okay? But I'm happy to answer any questions. It's 9:10. Yes, sir. I'll go in order. Okay?
You mentioned mechitzas.
Yes.
Which box is mechitzas?
Number two. The rabbis say very clearly that a mechitza is needed. In short, it's a clear halachic requirement to get rid of the mechitza completely in a place of worship in a Bet Knesset is a box number two. You need a Sanhedrin to do that.
Thank you.
Okay? Yeah, if you're davening in a house, you don't need a mechitza. Davening in the street, you don't need a mechitza. But in a shul, you need a mechitza. That's not something which is debated. Yes. Who are? So we heard, yes.
You mentioned partnership minyanim.
Yes.
What about women's minyanim?
Oh, that's very good. Women's prayer service. What about women's minyanim? Where the women want to have a prayer service, they want to read from the Sefer Torah, but it's just women, they're not trying to, you know... So, the question on these kind of issues is... Are they going to be run along clear halachic lines or are they not? Let's assume that they are, which is not always straightforward. Yeah. Even in the partnership minyan world, Rabbi Daniel Sperber, who is a very important instigator, and I didn't mean that in a negative sense, but he gives the imprimatur, if you like, to that movement. Many partnership minyan do things which he says is completely not okay, because once you open that box, you can't always close it. But if you had women in a very halakhic way, they're reading from a... I'd say that was box number four, quite honestly. Because there's no real halakhic issue. We pass them, for example, that women can have complete physical access to a Sefer Torah. That is a halakhic question, which is clearly passed in the positive. There's no problem with it. Women can carry a Sefer Torah, read from a Sefer Torah. Therefore, if women... I'm saying that it's something that I think that the rub of the community... I don't think you need the most senior people, because you're not really making a lack of change. You're just bringing a Sefer Torah into a women's only section. He has to decide whether he feels maybe that the agenda of the women is positive, or the men who want it is positive, or whether it's a good place, lead to a bad place. It's a judgment call. I think every community is different, and I understand there's an inherent... conservatism, especially in England, which England is a fairly little-c conservative society, no longer really a big-c conservative society.
Good.
Not at the moment, anyway, but we'll see what happens. Everything is cyclical, you know? But yeah, I can see why that's taking some time. There are people who feel that it's the thin end of the wedge and it's the slippery slope and all that, but you know something, I take the view, although I'm lucky to have no authority over anyone, you know, including myself, as far as my wife's concerned, but that's fine as well. The slippery slope is in two directions. You know, people are worried. It's not just one slippery slope. People are worried if you let this happen, then people get. But if you keep saying no to everything, then people just check out. So there's another slippery slope. There's no safe option. So it's a hard call. But I don't think that's box three. I think a partnership minyan is definitely box three. Definitely. because you're completely changing something which is halachically very clear right now, which is women cannot have aliyot, etc. I just did 3 shirim on partnership minyan. You can listen to them online if you like. I mean, they're interesting arguments, but women's minyan, I think, is women's, not minyan, women's prayer services, maybe box 4. And I think it'll happen when it needs to happen. And I think there is totally legitimate to lobby the rabbinate and to say we want this and this is why we want it, and we're not trying to make the United Synagogue into the conservative movement, etc., etc. And do what you can. Yes, Gideon.
So I'm struggling a little bit with box 3.
Yes.
You're using a definition of senior rabbi, which obviously is not really a well understood definition, unless obviously you define it by your example before was about some Abed Din or
yes.
Dayan, which is obviously a recognised tier of rabbanut, right?
Right.
But you know, even or in my experience anyway, you have a rabbi and you have a dayan, and you know, the bit in the middle is a bit
question marking, right?
So if you're relying on senior rabbi and
yes.
also relying on a framework that says this decision cannot be made by a junior rabbi or a junior rabbi,
right.
a senior rabbi, there's a lot of interpretation within that.
There is. I think in practice it kind of works itself through. For example, in a quite hierarchical society like England, where you have local rabbis and then a rabbinical dayanut structure like the United Synagogue, and then based in the Federation, based in the Kadassia, based in. So then I think that the people at the top of that chain are the senior people. The chief rabbi and his, you know, bet din are the senior people, and the local rabbis are the junior people. Let's say you take a more amorphous yeshivish type crowd where they're not part of a structure. They nevertheless see certain people as the gedolim in that community. There are certain shyness they won't ask, they'll push up to the gedolim. Yeah? And they'll ascend up. And there are fairly recognized gedolim. They're not self-appointed. The people decide who are the gedolim. Rav Moshe Feinstein, when he said in his introduction to his tshuvas, he says, who am I to be writing tshuvas for the whole Jewish people? Like, you know, he answers, I don't know. People send me questions. I wrote them answers, and they're answers. You can't fake the answers. They're amazing, and they're developed, and they're all thought. More people send questions. I gave more answers. And before you look around, the whole Jewish world's turning to this person, or a significant segment is turning to this person. They're a senior person. We decide who are the senior people. I think Rav Herschel Schechter is a senior person in the YU world. I think he has a certain role that the junior YU rabbonim don't have. And I think in practice, a lot of societies really have that, either hierarchically in a recognized way. For example, in Israel, I think the rabbanut, the Israeli rabbanuts, are not, even though they're the rabbanut, are not senior authority for many, many religious people in Israel. Because the rabbanut is seen as a government agency, and they do, you know, births, marriages, and deaths, and you know, da-da-da-da. So I think they are a rabbanut, but they're not really, they wouldn't be seen as a...
Who is?
What's that?
Who is in Israel?
There are people, each community turns to, well, it's interesting, we're kind of, this is my opinion, moving a little bit at the moment into, I think, a post-modern kind of approach to authority in halacha as well. I don't think we have these major rabbinic senior figures anymore. I think people are much more autonomous in their own communities than they used to be, and this is really Gideon's point, which is that there's these structures are not as clear cut as perhaps they used to be. I'm finding that more even within the Haredi world in Israel, which is ostensibly very subordinated to the Gedolim. That's just a narrative. It's not really what's happening on the ground.
You've explained that there are red lines, and there is flexibility, there is evolution, things do change.
Yes.
And there are examples where there are, you know, very difficult situations, and yet the two examples that come to my mind is obviously Agunot,
yes,
and generational mamzerus.
Generational mamzerus. Yes.
You know, being a mamzer is an indefinite thing.
Yes.
That can be very.
Although I'm not.
So these two examples. So they're my two. I can't.
Right. Remember. I understand. So, I'm not sure, practically speaking, how much of an issue generational mamzerus is. I don't know whether it is something which really is affecting numerous communities or not. I just don't know. My impression is that the Agunah issue is more significant.
No, obviously, but people like after World War II who turned out to be Mamzerim, and then obviously it's generational.
Right. So also, halakhically, we do everything we can to avoid deciding that someone is a Mamzer.
Right.
We don't look further than we need to, and we don't open up, you know, Pandora's box. We do a lot to avoid Mamzerim, and again, I'm not working in communal politics. I'd be interested to go to someone in the London basin, maybe Rabbi Schindler, let's say, who's been working in marriages for the last, I don't know, 40 years, and ask him how much of an issue is Mamzerim in practical terms in the community. I've never asked him that question. I doubt that it's a major one, but even if it were, The question is, what do you want to do about it?
Help the generations of those people.
Okay, good. You have to define what help means. Does help mean saying, well, that's not called them being a mamza anymore, which is probably a box one, because you can't just invent new things. Agunath, for example, to say that women can divorce men, you can't do. That's box one. To say that we're going to just unravel Kiddushin from the start, and when there's a problem, we're going to say, well, the marriage never happened, that's an interesting solution, but I'd say that's probably a box three, and there's a lot of downsides to doing that as well. Hafka'at Kiddushin was discussed a lot over the last 60 years, as whether you can just kind of just implode the marriage when there's a problem. And it's not so straightforward that that's a great idea. And most people are very opposed to it for good reasons. But the prenup agreement in most communities is considered to be a box four, probably. There's probably no real downside to filling in a prenup, which is the same basically as your ketubah, that says in the event that everybody falls out with each other, the following provisions will apply. And therefore, the prenup actually has done quite a lot to help in where there's a really strong prenup. It really strongly disincentivizes people from messing around. Is it a total solution? No. You could have a very rich, person, husband, wife, who's refusing a get for whom the money issue is not relevant, or a very poor one to say, yeah, fine, I owe you $1 million, sue me, I've got nothing anyway. But in most cases, it does help. But you have to look at what the prenup does. Not every prenup works as well as every other. It's not a perfect solution. But I think it's a box four solution. Yes? Medical issues like what? Give me an example.
Genetic problems with an embryo.
Okay, good. Good.
Where would you place that? Three?
Good. So, no, I don't think you place it at three. Meaning the issue of what you can or can't do with an embryo is a straightforward halachic question on which there are a number of different opinions, which are all legitimate opinions. It's not like we've been following one opinion only. For example, on the issue of time of death in Jewish law, and whether we follow the issue of heartbeat, whether heartbeat represents life in Jewish, in halakha, or whether brain activity represents life, and therefore a brain-dead person whose heart is beating is nevertheless considered halakhically dead. That's just a genuine debate within the halakha. There are two different views. You pick your rabbi and you follow that view. That's not a major change within anything. There have been those views for decades and decades. And if you want to have a halakhic organ donor card, so then you'll be, picking a rab that follows that view. That's fine. So I don't think that's a major issue. And the issue of genetic modification of embryos and things like that, again, almost all halakhic opinions take the view that embryos are not considered to be full halakhic life. Certainly in very early stages when they're not even being implanted. So actually, I'm not even sure that's a particularly controversial halakhic issue. Flushing an embryo, down the sink when you're not going to use it, it's not a major halachic issue. It's not a zero, but I don't think you need to be dealing with major halachic change on that particular question. It's a halachic shaila, and people are passing it in different ways, and there's pretty much consensus on it. So I don't get the sense that medical issues fall into that so much. Yes?
So there's certain minhagim that become very established and become treated as if it's halacha.
Yes.
Sometimes they're based on misunderstandings or
yes.
Understandings of how science was and things. How would they change? So, for example, can I have my herring and my
chollens
on the same plate?
Oh, interesting. So, you see, there's minhagim, and there's minhagim which find their way into the halachic system. The issue of eating fish and meat is in the Shulchan Aruch. It's not so straightforward to just kind of chop that out of Shulchan Aruch and say, we're not going to be particular about that. There were authorities, the Magen Avraham, that brings down that we're not as machmir when it comes to fish and meat issues, because we don't exactly see what the danger is. But there are others that take the other view, which is when there's a potential danger, maybe we didn't work out what the danger is. Don't tell me medical science has found out everything. They'll discover some new thing, and they'll say, oy vey, this has been caused, and maybe be more machmir. So the fish and meat issue is actually in the Shulchan Aruch, which makes it a halachic issue. Generally, minhagim, though, are minhagim. Minhagim are difficult, because minhagim are not made by rabbis. Minhagim are made by people. And when the community as a community has decided something, it's very hard to say how you change that. The only way you change that is really the community that made it is the community that unmakes it. Kitniot is a great example.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Kitniot was not made by rabbis. No rabbi stood and thumped on a desk and said, no one's going to eat rice. People, Ashkenazim, had bad experiences eating rice on Pesach. They were eating it, cooking it, and finding, oy vey, there's barley in my rice. Yeah, of course, because the market's all one big, mixed up thing. So they said, we're not going to eat it. So the only way Kinyan is going to change is when eventually, over time, the Ashkenazi community has decided that it's not going to do Kinyan anymore. I don't know, that looks like a long time. But it, Minhagim are Minhagim. They're very grassroots oriented. And they're very organic. They're very organic. So I don't think they work in quite the same way. Unless they find their way into the Halakha. Judith's Kinyan is in the Shulchan Aruch now, but even today I can see Kinyan changing in Israel a lot. A lot more mixed marriages in Israel.
Yes.
Sephardi Ashkenazi, and it's not as straightforward as it once was. And you see already, what's not going on. Okay, I think we need to stop because I need to move into the next stage. I hope that was of interest, relevant. Happy to. Please take my WhatsApp number. You can get it from Eleanor. And if you have any questions, reach out to me. I'll be very happy to answer them. Thank you very much again.
Thank you.